This is the Environment Show. It's about our stewardship of the Earth and the beauty and mystery of life in all its forms. I'm Peter Burley. Coming up, battles are raging about projects on the Pacific Coast which could threaten the environment. Mitsubishi wants to build a salt plant on a lagoon in Mexico used by whales to breed and calf. The state of California is suing the Department of the Interior, which has renewed some leases for oil drilling off the California coast. Listeners comment on discussions we broadcast concerning labeling genetically modified crops and government land purchases. And on the Earth calendar, elk in Arkansas have put on an extra layer of fat for winter. These stories and more coming up on the Environment Show. You're listening to The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. People who have seen the San Ignacio Lagoon on the Pacific coast of Baja California say it is one of the most beautiful, undeveloped areas on the Earth. The lagoon itself is used by gray whales, who come there to give birth and breed after migrating down the North American coastline. A controversy is now raging about the future of the area, which involves Mitsubishi, the Japanese multinational corporation, the Mexican government, the United Nations World Heritage Committee, and environmentalists in Mexico and the United States. Mitsubishi, in partnership with the Mexican government, proposed to expand an existing project and construct a huge salt works in the vicinity of the lagoon. Under the plan, settling ponds, thousands of acres in size, would be built, seawater would be let into the ponds, the sun and wind would evaporate the water, and the remaining salt would be scooped up, loaded into ships, and sold in international trade. The Mexican government rejected the proposal in 1995 because it found the environmental assessment inadequate. So Mitsubishi is now preparing another one, and the environmental community continues to organize against the project. Mario Aguilar is with the Ministry of Environment, Natural Resources, and Fisheries of Mexico.
It is very important to mention that in order to do that environmental impact statement, they would have to do it according to some parameters. And the most striking feature of this process is that SEMARNAT, the Mexican government, convened a panel of international scientific experts that were invited to provide their advice to us, the government, to seek and review the viability of any proposed project in this site. So far, they have given parameters to make the environmental impact statement, which are more stringent and rigorous than the ones prescribed so far by the law.
While the impact statement is still being prepared, Mitsubishi and the environmentalists differ sharply on whether the project will hurt the whales and what other impacts will occur. Jim Brum of Mitsubishi says the project can be a plus.
The proposed one would be in the part of the World Heritage Site, which are salt flats, essentially above or inland from the lagoon. The operation would not be in the lagoon, would not do anything to the lagoon other than pump water at one point from the lagoon. And I think the real issue is these salt flats, which really are devoid of life, essentially, whether they should be left pristine or whether there would be any adverse impact by flooding them. And when you flood them, what you do is really create a lot of biodiversity. It's an enormous attraction for migrating birds, for shorebirds.
Jacob Scher, Director of International Programs for the Natural Resources Defense Council, sees the process differently.
It also involves the production of huge amounts, literally millions of tons, of what is called bitter in brine. This is material that is a byproduct of salt production, and it is highly saline and has concentrations of various trace metals that appear naturally in salt water, but in these concentrations, in fact, are lethal to marine life.
Another major point of controversy relates to the development which will result from the construction and operation of the salt works. Environmentalists say a unique, pristine area will be spoiled. Again, Jacob Scher.
And what we're concerned about is if you build these salt works, it's going to draw a tremendous amount of new population into the area, which is going to put tremendous pressure on a whole range of species that live there, including the pronghorn antelope and sea turtles and so forth. So it's not just the saltworks itself, but it's the inevitable industrialization and urbanization that would accompany it as well.
Jim Brum from Mitsubishi sees it differently.
And if you go to Baja California, you fly over it, I mean, there's a lot of desert landscape. I don't think that this is a particular unique scenic landscape. I think the main thing and the very important thing is that whatever is done, it has to be done in a way that makes sure that the gray whale and that any other animals or plants are protected. And I think there is a controversy out there, but, you know, all we ask, we don't say people shouldn't oppose or have different opinions about the project. We just ask that people go through the process, which I think is an open and fair process, and that they examine the scientific evidence when the environmental impact assessment is released.
After the existing saltworks was built, the World Heritage Committee of the United Nations designated the area as a World Heritage Site. All sides of this controversy do agree that such a site should be protected, but there's disagreement as to whether the designation protects just plants and animals or wilderness and scenic values as well. UN scientists have just completed a study analyzing the present condition of the site. The study did not include an evaluation of the impact of the new saltworks proposal, but the opposing sides disagree on what the new report itself says. Mitsubishi and the Mexican government say it indicates the project can go ahead without damaging the World Heritage Site. The environmentalists say it has illuminated a bunch of yellow lights, and the UN scientists will reopen the study if the saltworks is approved by Mexican environmental authorities. Mario Aguilar says that this dispute has divided the Mexican people as well.
People are divided in Mexico. They have expressed views on this topic from both sides. However, one that has not probably been has not transpired here in the United States and other parts of the world is that Mexico is a developing country, and this facility could provide resources and jobs for some people. However, those same people that could be benefited would be very concerned if by doing so they are damaging the environment.
As it stands now, Mitsubishi is expected to file a new impact statement with the Mexican government in a couple of months, at which point the controversy will become even more intense. The California coastline is rich in biodiversity and beauty, and state officials are hoping to preserve what's there. In recent years, oil drilling was substantially curtailed after an offshore well exploded, contaminating miles of coastline. Now, the prospect that new sites could be open to drilling has the state concerned, and it's filed a lawsuit against the U.S. Department of the Interior. At issue is whether the Department of the Interior failed to include California in recent actions it took with respect to the renewal of offshore oil leases. The Environment Show's Stephen Westcott has more.
Years ago, oil companies paid millions of dollars for the right to drill for oil at 36 sites off the coast of California near Santa Barbara. No drilling has occurred at the sites, but in order to maintain the right to drill, the companies had to renew the leases. California opposed the renewals and told Secretary of the Interior Bruce Babbitt that the state would take legal action if the leases were approved. The department decided to renew the leases, but put them on hold. Tim Ahern is press secretary for the Department of the Interior.
We announced that there will be an indefinite suspension of all operations, which means no drilling. It will be for at least 18 months. While that suspension is going on, there will be a comprehensive environmental impact statement and study that will be done. It will be an area-wide environmental impact statement that will look at the impact all up and down the area where all 36 leases are.
After the suspensions were issued by the Interior Department, California filed a lawsuit in federal court alleging that the state should have had a say as to whether the suspensions were granted, an assertion lawyers for the government reject. But Mary Nichols, Secretary for the Department of Resources in California, says the 25-year-old Federal Coastal Zone Management Act mandates that state and federal activities have to be consistent with respect to oil drilling.
The program for federal leasing, and this has been contentious for many years, requires the federal government to confer with the state even though the development is actually outside the state's territorial limits. It's within the zone of the Outer Continental Shelf that's under the control of the federal government, where the state has no legal authority. But under the Federal Coastal Zone Management Act, which Congress has passed and amended several times, the federal government is required to work with the states and to make sure that any activities, any oil exploration and development activities that occur offshore of a particular state don't interfere with that state's coastal zone management program.
The federal government leases the offshore sites to oil companies and in return receives payments. Drilling has been occurring along California's central coastline for years, and the oil companies have a legal right to the 36 undeveloped lease sites. But Secretary Nichols says state officials are concerned about the health of California's marine ecosystems.
This would involve, in many cases, construction of new oil platforms, new drilling underwater, new potential for leaks and spills, and a great deal of disruption to the marine habitat, including a number of species of fish, birds, and in particular the California sea otter, which is currently a federal endangered species and whose populations are declining at a very alarming rate. We're seeing a dieback in the California sea otters that we really don't know how to explain.
At the Ocean Conference held last year in Monterey, California, President Clinton issued a moratorium on all new offshore oil drilling projects. However, that decision does not affect the 36 leases in question because they were acquired before the president's announcement. While she is pleased with the willingness by President Clinton and Secretary Babbitt to suspend the leases, Secretary Nichols says California is not letting up.
We certainly don't feel that we can just rest assured that nothing will happen, because the pressure that comes from the industry and from within the Minerals Management Service, which is one arm of the federal government, to keep this program alive and keep these leases alive is very strong.
Meanwhile, federal officials emphasize that the dispute between California and the Department of the Interior is centered around process, not goals. Again, Tim Ahern.
We share the same goals that the state does, which is protecting the coastline. And at some point in this process, later on in the process, the state will have an absolute veto. The State Coastal Commission will have a veto before these leases go ahead. They get an absolute up or down. And if they say no, the leases don't go ahead.
What Ahern does not say, though, is that the Interior Department can appeal to the Department of Commerce to open the lease sites to drilling. This could overrule an objection by the State Coastal Commission. If the Commerce Department okayed the drilling, the State Commission could then take the matter to court. But Tim Ahern stresses a lot of steps have to take place before any drilling occurs, which includes state involvement, environmental impact statements by the Interior's Minerals Management Service, and comments from citizens concerned about the projects. Meanwhile, Secretary Nichols says the state remains opposed to drilling on the renewed lease sites. She says California has done its fair share of providing the United States with oil and says 36 additional sites would only be a drop in the bucket. For The Environment Show, I'm Stephen Westcott.
The Environment Show is a national production. It's made possible by the W. Alton Jones Foundation, the William Bingham Foundation, the Turner Foundation, the J.M. Kaplan Fund, and Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the collector car hobby. www.hemmings.com. Our email address here at the Environment Show is green@wamc.org. That's green@wamc.org. We always want to hear from you, or you can write us, 318 Central Avenue, Albany, New York, 12206. We've been receiving a lot of calls from listeners in recent weeks. Lisa Phillips reports on what some of you have been saying.
A number of listeners responded to our discussion on whether products should be required to have labels saying they contain genetically modified crops. A representative from Consumer Reports spoke out in favor of labeling, while a spokesman for the Grocery Manufacturers Association of America voiced his opposition to such a move. Here's a sample of what some of you had to say.
One thing that particularly concerns me is why they would not want to put the labels on. It seems to be their argument that such labels will cause hysteria. But in actual fact, most people ignore a lot of the labels. And in fact, if you look at some of the chemicals that are listed on products, they're enough to scare anybody. But that hasn't caused hysteria. So my question really is, what have they got to hide?
On the labeling of genetic altered foods, and I do feel very strongly that there should be required a labeling to allow consumers to know what they are buying. There is no question about the feeling in a lot of people that genetically modified foods should be further tested. Not enough testing has been done.
I, as a consumer, believe that full information and full disclosure is essential for every activity in life. And in dealing with a technology that's fundamentally different from anything that's been done in all of human history in terms of food production, disregarding the fact that it's disingenuous, as the food producers state, that genetic engineering is comparable to hybrid breeding, which is not true. It's completely different. And it may be safe, and it may not be safe. And if it isn't unknown, I, as an intelligent person, having all information, would like the ability to choose for myself whether I want to subject myself and my family to what is fundamentally an experiment.
We recently featured a debate on federal land acquisition and whether it's an effective means of protecting natural areas. Roger Schlickhuysen, president of Defenders of Wildlife, spoke out in favor of more land acquisition. Kathy Benedetto, with the conservative organization National Wilderness Institute, said private citizens can do a better job of land management. A listener by the name of Barbara called in to say,
I heard your program on buying more wilderness land. I agree with the lady that you had on your published program that I just finished listening to. I agree with her. I don't think the government has been managing well what it already has, and I think you're also, in buying more land, you're getting involved with buying up private land, and frankly, I'm one of the people who feels threatened by such things. I feel that the government has not done a good stewardship job of what they have, and so to buy more with my tax dollar, I think is absolutely insane.
A few weeks back, we aired a discussion on whether private companies should be allowed to sell large quantities of water from the Great Lakes. A Massachusetts resident called with this to say.
I just heard your report on selling Great Lakes water, and I just want to thank you so much for covering that issue. It's something I never knew about and obviously then never gave it any thought. I think it's an important, important issue. And I'm thrilled that you covered it today. So this is just a thank you. I think in addition that we have to be multiply concerned about this, and the last comment about the importance of learning to live with the water we have and developing the technology to do that as the most important thing is, for me, the best summation of the significance of that report.
We appreciate all comments, questions, and suggestions. You can reach our comment line by dialing 1-888-49-GREEN. That's 1-888-49-GREEN. For The Environment Show, I'm Lisa Phillips.
Hello, operator, I want you to be mine. Please deposit all your love and put me on the line. I'm distant, under, lonely, lost, and feeling small. Dial directly to my heart and build me for the call.
And now it's time for the Earth Calendar. As we speak, elk are preparing for winter in the Ozark Mountains of Arkansas. There are about 500 elk that roam the some 220,000 acres of state and federal lands in the north-central part of the state near the Buffalo National River. Jim Spencer, information officer with Arkansas Game and Fish Commission, says an extra layer of fat helps keep the elk warm during the winter months. He describes what the elk eat to put it on.
Elk are grazers, where deer are mostly browsers. They eat twigs and nuts and, you know, forest products. Elk are creatures of the open land, and they eat grass mostly.
Besides putting on a little extra weight, elk acquire longer, thicker fur, which helps keep them warm during the cold months. A subspecies of the eastern elk inhabited the forests of Arkansas until the early 1800s, when the animal became extinct in the state. Overhunting and habitat loss were the primary reasons for their disappearance. Jim Spencer says the herd now found in Arkansas was part of a reintroduction effort that began almost 20 years ago.
We put them in stretched out over about a four-year period from 1981 to 85. It was a total of, 112 or something like that stock. Most of them came from Colorado, and we got seven or eight from Nebraska. They were, quote, nuisance elk, mostly from Colorado, out of the Fort Collins and Denver suburbs. They'd come out of the Rocky Mountains in the winter, as is their normal pattern. You know, they summer in the high country eating grass, and they winter in the low country eating grass. When they started coming back down to the low country, there were, lo and behold, there were suburbs in it, you know, and so instead of grass, they ate azalea bushes.
Spencer says the number of introduced elk has increased steadily in Arkansas over the years, so much so that the elk have at times roamed off public lands and onto nearby cattle pastures, which puts elk and cow in competition for the same grass. Recently, in an effort to keep the population from growing too large, the Arkansas Game and Fish Commission began allowing people to hunt some of the elk. Wildlife officials say hunting by humans replaces historic predation by wolves and mountain lions. The natural predators also became extinct years ago. Next to the moose, the elk is the largest hoofed mammal in North America. Bulls can stand up to 5 feet tall at the shoulder. Cows are a little shorter. Jim Spencer says they look like a white-tailed deer on steroids.
A mature bull will weigh 700, maybe 8. That'd be a real big one, an 800-pounder. But a good mature bull can go 700 pounds easily compared to a white-tail's 200 or so, you know, for a big buck. There's more contrast on an elk than there is on a whitetail. The upper part of their body and their neck, their neck and their belly, I'll put it that way, are real dark mahogany almost, and the main body is kind of fawn-colored, a tan more. They're real pretty animals.
Elk mate in early fall when Jim says bulls become boisterous.
Our elk go into the mating season usually in early September in Arkansas, and of course they bugle. They make a real high-pitched squealing sound, and if you've never heard it, when you do, it just raises the hair on the back of your neck. It's one of those wild, you know, indescribable sounds, kind of like a turkey's gobble, except more exciting, you know, because you know it's coming out of an animal the size of a Volkswagen.
Many of us talk about getting back to nature. As we lay on all that fat during this holiday season, perhaps we're taking a cue from the elk. But we do it better. I'll take eggnog and fruitcake any day over grass. You're listening to The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. This is the Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. Still ahead, ecotourism. Is it a way to bring needed cash to primitive peoples and encourage preservation of wild places? Or is it just another form of greenwashing that actually damages the wilderness by opening it up to exploitation? We talk green about it. An ecotourist who traveled throughout the Northeast was Henry David Thoreau, who died more than a century and a quarter ago. A scholar who has deciphered Thoreau's recently discovered last manuscript tells us about Thoreau's documentation of nature around him. Stay with us. We are Talking Green, and I'm Peter Burley. Today we're going to be talking about ecotourism. Does it provide the economic basis for sustaining beautiful and primitive places? Or does ecotourism and the label simply greenwash environmental destruction and exploitation of native peoples by avaricious tour companies and greedy tourists? That ought to evoke some response. My guests are Megan Epler-Wood. She is president of the Ecotourism Society, which is a nonprofit organization with about 1,500 private sector members all over the world. She's located in Vermont. Also with us is Kurt Kutai. He is director of Wild Land Adventures, which is a company based in Seattle, Washington. It offers ecotours. And also with us is Ray Rodney. He's special project manager of Wilderness Travel, which is an international travel company based in Berkeley, California. Megan, let's start with you from the Ecotourism Society. What is ecotourism?
Well, that's easy. Basically, it was defined back in the early 90s as responsible travel to natural areas that conserves the environment and sustains the well-being of local people.
And presumably, then, it encompasses whole lots of things in all sorts of places and is a service that's offered by a wide variety of guides and companies, I would say.
Yeah, it's actually one correction I wanted to make is that the Society represents more than the private sector because many nonprofit organizations are actually involved in ecotourism as well. For example, maybe your alumni association or all kinds of different nonprofits now are involved in developing ecotourism.
Now,
it is a worldwide phenomenon.
Kurt Kutai, you, as I understand it, are with a company that offers ecotours to people who sign up.
That's correct.
And what kinds of tours do you offer?
We offer trips to the rainforest and cloud forest in Costa Rica, where people can have a variety of experiences in nature. That is a destination where there's nature is more emphasized compared to, say, Panama, where you have a combination of nature and seven distinct cultural groups, which we interact with in a variety of ways on different kinds of tours. But our trips range around the world, throughout Latin America, African safaris, Amazon jungle expeditions. And then you have more cultural, historical-based trips, such as to Turkey in the Middle East.
And going to places of historic significance, many of which have architectural wonders in them, is something that's been going on for years. How is ecotourism, when you go to the Middle East, any different than any other tour that one might take there?
Well, ecotourism isn't just, as the name might imply initially, a nature tour. It is a form of tourism which, you know, contributes social and economic benefits at a local level. It needs to accommodate the aesthetic and experiential interests of the clients, and it also needs to maintain not only the ecological integrity, but also the cultural and, in many cases, archaeological, historical integrity of the area. So an ecotourism trip to a historical site in the Middle East would be one that minimizes its impact on historical resources. Hopefully it would contribute to their preservation.
Ray Rodney from Wilderness Travel, do you folk do both ecotourist trips and other kinds of trips as well?
Yes, we do. In a very similar way as to what Kurt was saying, we do have a lot of trips that are specifically directed at wildlife and natural history, you know, whether it's in places like the Galapagos or safaris in Africa or Costa Rica or other parts of the world. But we also have trips that are more oriented towards mountain culture and scenery or traditional archaeology and cultural travel, things of that type. And although we wouldn't necessarily call those eco-tours, we certainly, with all of the tours that we offer, try to do what we call responsible travel. And so that does involve respect for both the culture and the environment of the different places that we take people in terms of how we actually run the trip in the field, but also in terms of how we educate people and the support that we lend to both local and international organizations that are working to preserve traditional cultures and environments around the world.
Well, let me ask all of you about this notion that somehow ecotourism may be different. When I hear you talking about being responsible and having respect for cultures that you visit, for trying to cause as little damage as possible, that seems to me should be something that guides any kind of tourist activity. Does it make any sense to label some tourism as ecotourism and something else that's not? Why isn't every tourist activity designed and geared in a way that makes it ecologically sound and respectful of the places that it goes?
To start out, I think we could all answer that, but it's a niche market. I think it's very important to understand that in many ways, the marketplace defines what ecotourism is. And ecotourism is defined by small groups. Basically, the Ecotourism Society published guidelines for ecotours back in 1993. And one of the things that defined ecotours was that under 25 people would be in your group at any one time.
So these tour boats with thousands of people that are dumping pollution in Alaskan waters, those are not ecotours.
Right, yeah. You just saw that in the New York Times. I'm sure you did yesterday. It's a very good example of where you may be exposing people to nature, but you're not offering the same benefits that companies like Kurtz and Rays provide by way of that small group contact in which they can provide a learning experience and also pretty much guarantee low impact. So I'm sure both of them could address that.
Ray, what is the market? Who are the folk that you appeal to that go on ecotourism?
Well, that's hard to say. It's actually quite a diverse market of people, from people that are maybe lifelong Sierra Club members to people that have never been out of the U.S. before. I think what we would call the adventure travel market is definitely growing rapidly. There are more and more people that are willing to go out and try new things and go new places. You know, to go back to the question that you were asking, I think the operative word was when you said all tours should be responsible. And I think we would all certainly agree with that, but they're not all. And I think what Megan pointed out, the size of the group is a key factor, but also relations with the local people, using local guides, working with local organizations, supporting local institutions, teaching your travelers how to behave culturally or how to minimize their impact environmentally, giving them opportunities to contribute either while they're on the trip or when they come home. All of those kinds of things, you know, all add up to what we would consider to be a responsible form of travel. That many more traditional travel companies, whether they be large cruise companies or just large tour companies, they just don't really address those issues.
We've talked a little bit about the impact on civilizations and people that are visited. Kurt Kutai from Wildland Adventures, I noticed that in a recent ecotourism conference in Malaysia, one of the items on the agenda had to do with local folk sharing in some of the benefit of all of this. How does that work as a matter of principle, and who really sticks up for perhaps a primitive or less developed people and culture that suddenly finds themselves the object of an ecotourism trip?
Well, you know, this trend of ecotourism originally, I think, was evolved out of a demand from consumers who were concerned about the environment. They started looking for opportunities that they could minimize their impact on the environment and for companies that would provide that opportunity. And so one of the ways that we are able to support local people and make a difference is through a relationship with local ground operators who have the same values.
But how do you deal with the local operator who may indeed be exploiting his countrymen in ways that are just as bad as what would happen if you do it directly?
Well, you know, there are going to be companies that we can't control, that are going to exploit, that they're going to do things the way they want to do them. We carefully select and work with local operators, as I say, that share our values. And there's more and more of them, and organizations like the Ecotourism Society have established a network, created opportunities for all of us in the industry to communicate with one another through the web and through the membership. And so we are able now to know who's who in the business. And, you know, we have to carefully decide who we work with, and that's an important relationship that gets back eventually to the experience of the consumer, because it's impossible for us to maintain a direct, close working relationship on an everyday basis with individuals and local communities who need to be more involved and have a potential to benefit from the visit that we create through our consumers and our travelers.
Megan, is there any way that the tour operator or whoever is coming in from the outside can indeed either verify or hopefully make sure that some of the wealth that may be given to the local organizer indeed gets distributed and shared with the folk who are being looked at or being met or being seen by the tourist?
Oh, yes. I think that each of our operators look very closely at how their local partners manage their businesses. It's really a question of professional peer pressure that, you know, the Ecotourism Society is providing a network for.
And is there a standard in terms of how much gets shared or how you compute what it is that
you're
left behind?
Well, we do work with economists. One of our founders was Craig Lindberg, who has published any number of a very detailed analysis of how to look at how ecotourism contributes to countries. He was one of the first ones to analyze how the Mountain Gorilla Program worked for Rwanda and what kinds of economics benefits came to the local people. And what we found in the case of Rwanda is that actually tremendous benefits did come to local people. And so the sort of model that has now been replicated throughout the world shows that there's always room for improvement. But in fact, compared to traditional tourism, there's no question that ecotourism offers a lot more local economic benefits.
And presumably then it, and I'm challenging you now, doesn't it self-destruct? If the benefits are real and are imparted, and there's a primitive society involved, if they're like everybody else, after a while they would rather wear Levi's and have a satellite dish than continue in their native ways. So does ecotourism simply provide a brief window on a society which, by definition, it will destroy?
Well, I just did a whole quarterly for Cultural Survival, Peter, on that subject, you know, working with indigenous authors on what their choice is by way of what they want for economic development. And I think sometimes we have this artificial view that indigenous people should be living without, you know, westernized development and all of the types of conveniences that we have. But if you take a look at what the majority of indigenous people are demanding throughout the world, it is equal access to economic development opportunities in a way that they can control. And so, in fact, tourism is one of their top choices throughout the world because it enables them to stay where they are, pick the type of economic development that they want. It helps to reinforce their culture, which is very unusual. And it also keeps their kids at home as opposed to the dramatic flight to the cities that is happening worldwide. So it is an import economy, one of the few that indigenous people have access to. There are problems, definitely, and there needs to be more guidelines and more empowerment so that they understand exactly how to control this economy. But it is largely to their benefit.
And local people are also not really necessarily looking for money. I mean, in many cases, their first priorities are better health care,
right,
better education, better transportation, and tourism, even in a small-scale way at a local level, can benefit those needs first.
Right.
I would presume also that one of the big advantages of this is that it does hopefully provide tremendous incentive to leave natural systems alone. the jungle standing versus clear cut for some other purpose.
Yeah, well, both Ray and I have worked in Ecuador with Randy Borman, who's a very well-known leader, a missionary son who ended up leading a well-known indigenous group called the Kofan to fight against oil companies, move their village away from oil pollution, and ultimately establish their own ecotourism program.
And Ray, in this situation, did it actually keep the forest standing up?
It has helped a lot. You know, when a small tribe in Ecuador goes up against the big oil companies, they don't always win. But it has, in fact, resulted in the establishment of a forest reserve, and their village is still there, and they are still able to live their lives in the way that they want to, which is not completely traditional, but as Kurt was saying, they don't want it to be completely traditional. Part of the reason why a lot of local people like the idea of ecotourism is it does give them the opportunity to advance in certain ways, like better health care and better education for their children. Randy, as an example, hosted small groups of our clients who would go into this Kofan village on the Aguarico River in Ecuador. But he had it set up in such a way that the main group of Kofans were able to live their lives basically without interference, but a number of them would host our groups when they came in specially built accommodations there on the side of the village. And it provided a fascinating experience for the travelers and gave the Kofans great incentive to maintain some of their cultural traditions as well as the forest around them. So that's one example where the economics of tourism, of bringing money in, can become significant enough that it becomes more valuable, for example, than cutting the trees down.
I want to thank my guests, Megan Epler-Wood from the Ecotourism Society, Kurt Kutai from Wildland Adventures, and Ray Rodney from Wilderness Travel. You may have ideas about ecotourism, and we'd like to hear them. So give us a call. Our number is 1-888-49-GREEN. We've been talking green, and I'm Peter Burley. Tell us how to rewrite the environment show by answering the questionnaire on our website. It's www.enn.com/envshow. That's www.enn.com/envshow. While you're there, you can listen to the show on your personal computer. While he died more than 130 years ago, the words of Henry David Thoreau are coming alive today. Thoreau's last book, which he was writing at the time of his death, is now appearing across the country in bookstores. It's the first time it has been published and is a major find for environmentalists and Thoreau lovers. The Environment Show's Stephen Westcott reports on the history of the work and its significance.
Thoreau was in the process of writing the book Wild Fruits when he died in 1862. He died without a will, and the unpublished manuscript went to his sister, Sophia.
When Sophia died about 20 years later, she willed them to Thoreau's principal correspondent and disciple, H.G.O. Blake of Worcester, Massachusetts. Blake, when he died in about 1898, willed them to a one-time acquaintance of Thoreau's, Worcester High School principal named E. Horrell Russell. Russell didn't know Thoreau very well, didn't value the manuscripts as much as Sophia and Blake did, and as a consequence sent most of them off to New York to a manuscript dealer who put them on consignment, and they were purchased by various moguls of the time, you know, big businessmen who had manuscript collections like Mr. Pierpont Morgan and S. Howe. These particular manuscripts went to Howe, and then from Howe's collection, they ended up in the collection of Dr. Berg, who within a year gave his collection to the New York Public Library.
That's Bradley Dean, a literary scholar with the Thoreau Institute's Media Center in Lincoln, Massachusetts. Until recent years, Wild Fruits sat unpublished in the New York Public Library, mainly because no one could read Thoreau's handwriting well enough to put it into book form. Fortunately, after 25 years of working with and studying Thoreau manuscripts, Bradley Dean acquired the ability to understand Thoreau's penmanship. In 1996, he took on the job of editor and began transcribing the Wild Fruits manuscript on a full-time basis. Besides the challenge of transcribing Thoreau's handwriting, Dean was faced with an additional problem. Years of being passed from person to person put the manuscript severely out of order.
So we had early draft manuscripts, the first draft, second draft manuscripts in there, all of his working notes, and then the final draft manuscripts, and all of them were mixed up, and we're talking here about 642 manuscript pages. So my task was to, of course, sort through those and essentially reconstruct Thoreau's composition process so I could winnow out working notes and earlier drafts, and of course use those drafts to confirm the final draft of the manuscript text.
Dean finished editing Wild Fruits in 1997, which has now been published. This isn't the first time he has transcribed an unpublished Thoreau manuscript. Earlier this decade, Dean translated Dispersion of Seeds. As for Wild Fruits, Dean says it reads as a botanist's journal.
On the most basic level, everyone would be able to pick the book up, read through it, and see what Thoreau was doing. Again, at the, you might say, the surface level. He was a field botanist who was going out and surveying the fruits, the produce of the landscape, from the time the first fruit ripened, the elm seed, in, I believe it was early June, all the way through to some of the what he calls winter fruits, the fruits that ripen into November. There are 181 fruits that are mentioned, all in the sequence they ripen in the Concord area.
Thoreau details the ripening of everything from European mountain ash to sweetbriar, wild apples to painted trillium. But there's a much deeper message in Wild Fruits. Thoreau points out that by appreciating the beauty and wonder of plants, one encounters the spiritual essence of nature. It is through spiritual intuition that one finds the nature of reality. That was a philosophy of the Transcendentalist movement in New England, whose members included Thoreau. In Wild Fruits, Thoreau brings the reader to what Bradley Dean calls the sacramental layer, which he says is analogous to the Christian Eucharist.
You take the bread and the wine as symbols of, you might say, a spiritual reality. And Thoreau does the same thing. He speaks about the huckleberry, for instance, and the other berries as being a sacrament in a communion with nature, inviting us to, Thoreau says, a picnic with all nature. Thoreau believed that that nature is, in some sense, divine, and it's interesting to me to see how he explored that particular meaning in the landscape.
Dean says readers familiar with Thoreau's best-known works, such as Walden and Civil Disobedience, will find similar themes in Wild Fruits. He believes the book is another piece to the puzzle of understanding the 19th-century naturalist and his beliefs.
To me, the most interesting component of this text is the way Thoreau amplifies, you might say, his insight, now almost a commonplace, that in wildness is the preservation of the world. In this book, he's amplifying that particular insight and treating it in a variety of different ways so that it becomes a lot easier for even Thoreauvians, scholars of Thoreau and close readers of Thoreau, to kind of get their minds around what he meant by that statement. What he is essentially saying is, while we need to be careful to preserve wild areas in the environment, the reason they're so important is that they kind of correspond to an inner wildness, you might say. It's almost as though the wild, the outward wild, the wild in the landscape, prompts us to a recognition of, as Thoreau puts it, who we are and where we are.
Environmentalists and various scholars have debated Thoreau's role in the environmental movement in America. While Wild Fruits does not answer the question of whether Thoreau was the father of environmentalism, it does show that he was a progressive thinker, far ahead of his contemporaries. Again, Bradley Dean.
From my own point of view, and I think this book will cement it, the last section of this book is a very, very cogent and compelling and beautifully written argument for preserving wild spaces. And if Walden's various passages from Walden and obviously Thoreau's journal can be mined, it's a massive work, but it can be mined for many, many what we would now regard as ecological insights and arguments. The most wonderful parts about this book is it really, I mean, no one now that this book is out can say that Thoreau, if not the first environmentalist, certainly the one who wrapped up the case for preserving the environment.
In Wild Fruits, Thoreau writes, "I know it is a mere figure of speech to talk about temples nowadays when men recognize none and associate the word with heathenism. Most men, it appears to me, do not care for nature and would sell their share in all her beauty for as long as they may live, for a stated and not very large sum. Thank God they cannot yet fly and lay waste to the sky as well as the earth. We are safe on that side for the present. It is for the very reason that some do not care for these things that we need to combine to protect all from the vandalism of a few." Close quote. The book is Wild Fruits by Henry David Thoreau, edited by Bradley Dean and published by W.W. Norton & Company. For The Environment Show, I'm Stephen Westcott.
Thanks for being with us in this week's Environment Show. I'm Peter Berlich. Neither Mitsubishi Mexican salt or California oil applied to the tail of an Arkansas elk will help you catch one if you're an ecotourist or simply observing nature like Henry David Thoreau. So order a copy of this show, number 519, for the catchy theme music. Call 1-800-323-9262. The Environment Show is a national production which is solely responsible for its content. Alan Shartok is executive producer. Stephen Westcott is producer. The show is made possible by the W. Alton Jones Foundation, the William Bingham Foundation, the Turner Foundation, the J.M. Kaplan Fund, and Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the collector car hobby. www.hemmings.com. Be good to the earth and join us next week for The Environment Show.